All rise. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of Wisconsin is now in session. Your silence is commanded.
Please be seated. Well, good morning. We have a full house, which is always nice for us to look out there and see so many people who are interested in our rulemaking processes. The first matter is Petition 1704. And Attorney Levine, you are the presenter. We have many people who have signed up so far to speak either in support or in opposition to that petition. And in the interest of hearing everyone, Attorney Levine, I will give you 10 minutes to begin. I will give everyone else 5 minutes, and if you don't need the 5 minutes, please don't take it. Then, Attorney Levine, I will let you again respond before we conclude the hearing on that matter. So I'll go down the list that I have. When I get to the end of the list, if someone is here and hasn't signed up, that's quite all right. We certainly will be happy to hear from each and every one of you. Our trusty Marshall will keep track of the time for us. When the red light comes on, you really need to sit down. Now, the materials that have been presented in regard to this petition are excellent, and we have all read everything you've given to us. So don't waste your 10 minutes or your 5 minutes telling us what you already said in writing, because we know what you said. We know what those arguments are. So you may present as you choose, but I think you will help us most if you add to what has been submitted rather than repeating what we've already read. So, Attorney Levine, you may proceed.
Let me just say at the outset, I'm a little concerned with the restriction on time. I see this petition as going to the essence, as the state bar has indicated in its response to your very existence. And I would hope that there be some indulgence from some members of the state bar if they feel the need to expand more than 5 minutes in support of their existence. And also the same to Attorney Levine.
I appreciate your concerns, Justice Bradley, but as the Chief Justice, I will conduct the hearing. You may continue.
I understand that you'll conduct the hearing.
Thank you, Justice Bradley. We're going to begin with the hearing now.
Things are more important than whether someone has 5 minutes or 7 minutes.
I totally agree with you, and I will conduct the hearing accordingly. Please begin.
According to the
Levine.
Court's practice and the majority rule. Okay. That's how proceedings are conducted.
Please continue, Attorney.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to be as brief as possible. If it pleases the court, good morning, Your Honors. My name is Steve Levine. I'm an attorney from Madison. I am the petitioner in this rulemaking proceeding. I'd like to divide my presentation into three parts. First, to describe for the court what the change in language in Supreme Court Rule 1003-5B1 would accomplish. Second, to briefly state the reasons for the proposed change. And third, to state why the change would be beneficial and useful to all of the stakeholders in this proceeding. What the petition requests of the court is to change Supreme Court Rule 1003-5B1 to change the standards under which the state bar can spend mandatory dues. The two standards that are there now are the vague standards of regulating the legal profession or improving the quality of legal services. What the proposed rule would do would substitute for those two standards specific activities named particularly which the state bar could spend mandatory dues on. All other activities would have to be supported by voluntary dues.
So you'd keep one state bar, but it would have two functions and use two different sources of funding.
Precisely. The rule is patterned on what the Supreme Court of Nebraska did 4 years ago. In a rulemaking proceeding, after inspecting all of the U.S. Supreme Court precedents, which I cited in footnote 4 of my memo, the Supreme Court of Nebraska concluded that its integrated bar must be limited to performing regulatory functions only with mandatory dues. And the court specified what those regulatory activities were and determined that all other activities should be supported by voluntary dues. What are the reasons for the proposed rule in Wisconsin? Two things happened in Wisconsin, I think, that have led to my petition in this proceeding. One, the character of the state bar has completely changed from what it was originally proposed. Some 60 years ago, when the state bar was originally integrated, the purpose of the bar was to be a regulatory agency which would regulate and supervise both ethics and education in Wisconsin. When the Lathrop case went to the U.S. Supreme Court, the Attorney General represented to the U.S. Supreme Court that the bar would supervise and police legal ethics and education in Wisconsin. He specifically used the term governmental agency. And in approving the U.S. Supreme Court on a constitutional basis, the U.S. Supreme Court said that the bar would be part of a regulatory program. So the entire purpose of the bar was to be a regulatory agency. But that didn't last very long.
Counsel, would your petition, if we accepted it, change the scope or authority of the state bar in total, aside from how we divide voluntary from mandatory duties or dues? Would it change in any way what the state bar does?
Well, it would do two things, Justice Kelly. First of all, it would make sure that for those regulatory activities that the bar does engage in, or those activities designed to protect the public from harm, there would be adequate funding for those activities to continue. No one is arguing that regulatory activities designed to protect the public should be exempt from every lawyer's obligation to support those. What it would also accomplish, however, which I think would be beneficial to the bar, is with voluntary dues, the bar would be free, just as any voluntary association, to use those funds as it best sees fit.
I don't understand what's voluntary and what's not voluntary dues. First of all, would everyone who's a member, wants to be a member of the bar and practice in the state, have to pay dues and the same amount?
No, they would have to pay the mandatory dues, but the choice as to whether to pay the voluntary dues would be up to the state bar.
So when would notice be given to me as a member of the state bar of how much I had to pay as mandatory dues?
The dues statement would go out the same time that they go out now.
But who decides how much I pay? Right now, the court does, doesn't it?
The state bar would set a budget
for
those mandatory dues.
So it figures out how much is mandatory?
Pardon?
So the state bar figures out how much is mandatory?
Yes.
What happens when you litigate that with them?
I can't see, practically speaking, that there would be any litigation on that.
What about arbitration? You don't like the word litigation, arbitration.
Or arbitration. I mean, the rule would list the specific activities that the state bar could charge mandatory dues on. I don't see what differences of opinion there would be that would lead to arbitration on that.
Well, what about lobbying? Isn't some lobbying okay and some not okay for mandatory dues under your view?
No. No lobbying would be allowed. Because, as this court has determined in the past, the legislature has no jurisdiction either over lawyer ethics or lawyer education.
What about your judicial salaries?
Pardon?
What about judicial salaries? I think that's a good idea, don't you?
I can see why you might think that's a good idea, Your Honor, but...
I could see why you would think it's a good idea.
I hope that we have arrived at a point in this state that everyone can conclude that forcing people into an organization that lobbies the legislature on issues and principals that they disagree with, against their will, with their mandatory dues. There's something wrong with that.
Well, there is no, I don't think, can't think of any issue that won't have at least one opponent.
Well, to give an example, what was involved in the arbitration case, the decision provided to the court with this petition, the bar lobbied on a constitutional amendment to change terms of Supreme Court justices. The bar lobbied on the salaries of judges and attorneys employed by the state. The bar lobbied on the state statute concerning substitution of judges. All those are political issues on which members of the bar have reasonable differences of opinion. No one should be forced to participate in the political or legislative process against his or her will, with his or her money. I mean, I can't think of a more stark violation of constitutional rights than to force someone who doesn't want to participate in the legislative process to do that. If an activity is regulatory, then a person has a responsibility to pay for the costs of that regulation. Nobody argues that. It's always been black-letter law that the costs of regulation, whether it's of lawyers or any profession, are to be paid by those who are regulated.
Attorney Levine, you addressed those points very, very well in the filings to the court. One thing that bothers me, though, is something I didn't find in your filings or anybody's filings who responded. I don't think your petition lists those items that are mandatory, in your view, nor does it have any listing of the financial impact granting your petition would have on this court's budget. Did you consider those items? And if you did, if you'd address them, I would appreciate it.
Sure. I think the rule itself lists those activities that would be mandatory activities that the state bar could collect mandatory dues on. When the state bar participates in regulatory proceedings before this court, that would be an expense that all bar members would share in. State bar administering the fund for client protection, state bar administering WSLAP, the specific activities that are regulatory or to protect the public interest are listed in the rule.
The other one is the offering legal advice on ethical questions that you listed. Is that
right.
Correct? So those four plus the fifth one was a catch-all, as I recall.
It is. And the list is not meant to be closed-ended. If the state bar or if the court thinks there's some activity that's regulatory or necessary to protect the public from harm, those can be added to the rule.
Counsel, how would having this bifurcation affect the financial perspectives of the court? Because there are many things that the state bar does now on its budget from the fees it collects from lawyers rather than from general purpose revenues, which the court controls.
The rule is specifically designed, Your Honor, to continue the state bar's role as a trusted advisor to the court. The court has often called on the state bar's experience and expertise in rulemaking proceedings and advising the court on changes, proposals to change, ethical considerations, educational considerations. That would continue under the rule. The rule specifically says that state bar expenses in participating in rulemaking proceedings, if the state bar is assigned or on its own, does a research project to update either ethics or educational rules. If the state bar participates in a rulemaking proceeding before this court, all those expenses would be part of the regulatory process and would be continued to be supported by all state bar members. If that specific provision that I tried to write, which would continue the state bar's role in this process, needs refining, that's fine with me. But I specifically put that in there because I know in the past the state bar's advice, experience, and expertise has been valuable to the court, and that should continue.
Counsel, the state bar has helped to fund the Access to Justice Program and Committee and Initiative. Would that possibility continue under the contours of your proposed rule?
It would continue as a voluntary bar expense.
So not as a mandatory bar, not as a mandatory expense, but only as a voluntary expense.
And I don't think there would be a problem with that, Justice Bradley. What I specifically went out of my way to mention in my reply brief was to look at what the bars of our surrounding states do. Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, all voluntary bars, all of them have access to justice proposals, pro bono proposals. They do exactly the same activities that the state bar now does, and I expect that would continue.
You've listed what you consider the core or the essential mandatory items. My concern is where you draw the line. From my perspective, access to justice is at the core of what we're doing. And so others may disagree, but where do you draw that line vis-a-vis something like access to justice, making it voluntary rather than mandatory?
I think that the line should be drawn very sharply between what is regulatory and what is necessary to protect harm to the public, and those two concepts often overlap. And what is perhaps a good thing that we want the state bar to engage in, but is non-regulatory. The key word should be regulatory. That's what the state bar was originally intended to be. That's what the U.S. Supreme Court upheld it as. And all of the activities, I think, which are supportable by mandatory dues should be either regulatory activities or designed to prevent harm to the public. But those public activities that the bar does.
Counsel, I'm curious about whether your petition actually accomplishes your goal. I understand your concern to be twofold with respect to how dues are used. One, that you should not be compelled to financially support views with which you may disagree. Two, that you should not be forced to associate with an organization that is espousing views with which you may disagree. Right?
Your Honor, excuse me. I'm having a great difficulty hearing. The sound system in the court is not
sure.
The best.
We
it
can't
could
hear
be
him on the bench either, Mr. Levine.
So,
I don't either.
I understand your concern to be twofold with respect to the bar and the views that it advocates. One, that you are being required to financially support views with which you may disagree. And two, that you're being required to associate with an organization that espouses views with which you may disagree, right? Okay. So it appears to me that your petition takes care of one but not the other and may actually exacerbate the other. So we divide the budget into two, mandatory and voluntary, and that takes care of the requirement that you financially support views with which you might disagree. But that then frees up the bar to pursue its own views on any variety of issues, and it might decide that it is appropriate for it to become even more politically active with those voluntary dues. But then you're still associated with that group, and you'd still be associated with a group with which you may disagree about how they espouse their views. So does this petition take care of that second piece, and if so, how?
I think it does, because I think that members of the bar as well as the public will understand that the only reason lawyers are being required to be members of the bar is to meet their regulatory obligations, but that they don't necessarily agree with other activities of the state bar. The proposal in this rule is a compromise. There are some activities that the state bar now performs which can be classified as either regulatory or designed to protect public harm. Other things, such as legislative lobbying, such as engaging in a public relations advertising campaign to improve the image of the profession, that are non-regulatory, those are the activities that this rule would give lawyers the freedom from having to support.
How would a Keller review occur under your bifurcated proposal?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear again.
Keller review, how would that occur? How would there be Keller compliance under your bifurcated proposal?
I don't think disputes as to compliance would come up very often at all, Your Honors. As long as the rule lists the specific activity that the state bar can spend mandatory dues on, when arbitrations have happened in the past, I don't think there's ever been an arbitration about the accuracy of how much money the state bar has spent on a particular item. It's always been on the issue, the substance of what it was spent on, rather than the amount. So I don't think that would be a problem in the future.
Is the effect of your proposal to reduce the state bar to a voluntary bar?
It would make the state bar a voluntary bar with respect to those activities that are non-regulatory. It would be mandatory in the sense that all regulatory activities, all activities designed to prevent harm to the public, would still be mandatory and still be supported by all lawyers of Wisconsin.
So would the bar have to send out in July two types of dues and say X amount or your mandatory dues for the mandatory programs in sub C, and if you want to engage in the voluntary activities of the bar, you can pay X amount?
I would assume that the dues statement would list those mandatory dues and then the voluntary dues, and people, if they wanted to pay the voluntary dues, would check that off on the dues statement.
So the dues statement would have two types of dues. And the mandatory, you'd have to pay if you want to practice law in Wisconsin. And the other aspect of the dues, you don't have to pay because they're forcing you to...
In fact, right now, the dues statement, I believe, if I remember correctly, has a provision that allows people to contribute to the Wisconsin Bar Foundation.
Well,
so it would be similar to that.
Well, I haven't looked at the bar's dues statement recently, but it has an amount... flat amount, and then it has somewhere down below you can deduct a smaller amount, very much smaller, usually below $10 if my memory is correct, because that's the amount attributed to lobbying, which you aren't required to support. Isn't that right?
Right, but the bar, under this proposed rule, the bar wouldn't have to do that because aside from regulatory activities, the bar would be free to spend those voluntary dues however it wanted, which is what it should be free, just as any other voluntary association.
It still has to calculate the dues that I have to pay, right?
Yes.
And how does it do that?
Well, as the rule said, you just separately account for those. You put the voluntary dues in one account and the mandatory in another.
Sure. And how do you account for the expenses? Because things overlap. Person is hired as a secretary. Secretary does a whole lot of different stuff. Some that would fall under mandatory dues and some under voluntary dues. So how is all that calculated? And how can I object?
The bar has an excellent auditing staff. And in the past, the bar has attributed certain overhead and certain time spent at Board of Governors meetings to what it can spend money on and what it can't spend money on. And I assume the same thing would happen.
Thank you, Attorney Levine.
If I could add just
one more
question.
He's going to be back at the end. So if you want to ask it now, please go ahead. But I want to give him a chance to respond to what others say as well.
Yeah, just real briefly. So the petition seems to simply be expanding the Keller exception. You mentioned that this would create a voluntary bar. But I'm interested in what way it would be voluntary other than moving more things into the Keller bucket, because you'd still have whatever publications the state bar issues, they're still going to be there, and they're going to cover both mandatory and non-mandatory stuff. They'll still have their annual meeting that'll cover mandatory and voluntary materials. Still have their same Board of Governors meetings at which they address mandatory and voluntary issues. Now, on down the line, it doesn't seem like there's any actual bifurcation at all other than how you account for the dues, and all attorneys will still be required to be a part of the bar. So this doesn't seem like it accomplishes anything other than moving some additional items into the Keller bucket. Am I wrong?
Well, if you're intimating, Your Honor, that the only way of accomplishing this would be to have a totally voluntary bar, I can't disagree with you. This proposal is a compromise. It's a compromise because there are already a few activities within the bar, the Fund for Client Protection, WSLAP, that I think are regulatory activities that should be supported by all lawyers. I suppose one solution might be to remove all those regulatory activities from the bar so that the bar is totally a voluntary organization and doesn't do regulatory activities. But I think as a practical matter, since they're within the bar already and the bar has experience in doing them, the best way to do it is to have this bifurcated function of the bar, part of it mandatory to support those regulatory activities and part of it voluntary.
Thank you very much, Attorney Levine.
I have a question of clarification from my colleague, Justice Kelly. I didn't quite understand or hear part of your question. You listed publications, Board of Governor meetings, and annual meetings. And was that premised on those being mandatory or voluntary? I just didn't catch that.
Well, that was kind of the question.
They were overlapping, is
right.
What he was saying.
They would cover both, right? And under the proposal, it would appear that they would continue to cover both.
And publications, you think, covers both?
Yeah, I think it certainly seems to be, yeah.
Thank you very much, Attorney Levine. We will have you back again at the end. You've gone way beyond 10 minutes, but it's in proper answering to the questions from the court, and I do appreciate that.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We're going to move
I agree with you. It seemed a lot longer than 10 minutes.
We're going to move now to Dean Dietrich, I think, who is the first one on my list. After that, I have Attorney Kammer, Attorney Essenberg, and Attorney Swanson, so you kind of know the order that I'm following.
May it please the court. My name is Dean Dietrich. And I am not here today speaking as part of the delegation from the State Bar of Wisconsin. I do admit that I serve as the chair of the Committee on Professional Ethics for the State Bar. But I'm here today speaking for myself, and I think, and I hope, that I am thinking, I'm also speaking my dear departed partner, Lane Ware. I'm not sure what we are considering today, as I've listened thus far to the proceedings before the court, whether we are considering a petition that would change the process for determining whether or not certain payments are mandatory dues payments or certain payments should be excluded as not qualifying as mandatory dues payments, or whether we're here today speaking on whether or not the State Bar of Wisconsin should be a voluntary bar. As you might suspect, I have opinions on both, but I will try and... My apologies.
That's our sound system.
I think it was Justice Ziegler.
Yeah, I'm back. Sorry.
Okay.
I have opinions on both, but I would like to address first and foremost the procedure being proposed within the petition. I have served as a representative for management in labor relations and labor arbitrations for 40 years. Arbitrations are not perfect. The process of arbitration is not perfect, but it is the best that the systems, all types of systems, have agreed to use to resolve disputes, to resolve them economically, to resolve them efficiently. That's the process that the bar uses for determining whether or not certain expenditures should be considered mandatory or voluntary. And others will speak to that. I speak to you because I've experienced arbitration, and I believe that the system that we currently have is works and it is the most efficient way to address the issue. The commission is obviously going to provide that if there is a question as to whether something is funded by mandatory use or funded by voluntary use, it would go to a proceeding before this court. I know in the commission that there's an acknowledgement that things that are done by the bar to educate lawyers about compliance with the rules of professional conduct would be funded by mandatory rules. As you may know, I write an article every month in Wisconsin Law. I write that article every month because Chapter 20 of the Rules of Professional Conduct says a lawyer should seek improvement of the law, access to the legal system, the administration of justice, and the quality of service rendered by the legal profession. I take it as my responsibility as chair of the media on professional ethics to help lawyers by writing those.
Counsel, do you think this petition would affect that at all?
I'm afraid, Your Honor, that it may.
How?
And here's why. It's not clear to me. It seems to me that the petition says the only education law complies with the rules. Except the only way I can accomplish that is through Wisconsin lawyer. And Wisconsin lawyer, I do not think would be funded by mandatory rules.
And do you think that the Wisconsin lawyer would no longer be published as a consequence?
I would think it would be published. I would think it might be a different tone, a different focus, and perhaps different narratives. In addition, Justice, I'm concerned that if my article doesn't fall under this test, I have to submit it to the court. Does this qualify under the rule to be an education piece about compliance with the rules of professional conduct? Let me suggest that if that is what happens, we see far less arguments fought for that purpose.
So what do you want, Mr. Diedrich? Mr. Diedrich? Mr. Diedrich? What is it you want this court to do?
Pardon?
What is it that you want this court to do?
I would recommend to this court that this petition be denied. Yet the court feels that there needs to be further review of what the bar does. I can understand that would be an appropriate action for this court to take.
Yes, I noticed that, let's see. I suggested many a year ago that the bar had not been studied since 1983 and proposed that there be a study of the state bar when this issue of voluntary versus mandatory keeps cropping up. And it was not adopted then. I dissented and it was not adopted.
From my perspective, I would welcome the opportunity to have someone study what we do on the Committee on Professional Ethics, in particular what we do to educate lawyers about compliance with the rules of professional
ethics. Yeah, I'm talking about a study of what the state bar does. I mean, if you can make me pay the dues or everyone else pay the dues, I want to know what you do that really gives me value. And when I say me value, I don't think it means me personally or any other lawyer personally. I think it means what are my dues that are mandatory and given to the state bar? What is the state bar doing to have access to justice for all people in the state.
And again, Justice, from my perspective, access to justice is important, as is improvement of the law, as is the administration of justice and the quality of service. And I would welcome the opportunity to have someone study what we do as it relates to educating lawyers.
Thank you. Did you want to, we were trying to make some kind of a closing statement when you got that last question. Is there something you'd like to say in conclusion?
I would say in conclusion, Chief Justice and members of the court, that the petition process doesn't make sense to me. One of my proudest moments as a lawyer is when I participated in a program where we taught the clergy about the law. I can't do that myself. I need to have the bar doing those things together. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Attorney Kammer, are you up next?
May it please the court, I will be mercifully brief. I read over all of this material that came in from all the sides, and I noticed that no author, I didn't check every time, could use the word freedom of speech without the term freedom of association, as if those two things were just a wad. And they're not, in my view. And so I want to talk about freedom of association very briefly, because I think it plays into this. I don't think that this august body can require me to join the Elks Club or the Baptist Church or anything like that. I think I have a right to make my own decision, and I'm concerned about being required to associate with the state bar. I want to talk about that very quickly.
You don't want to associate with the state bar, is that right, Mr.
I want to have the freedom to make my own choice about that.
Okay.
I don't want to be forced to do that. I'm a past president of the state bar, and I had some things happen, and you're aware of most of them, that I think should free me from having to
associate. Am I right in remembering that you ran on the platform of not having a mandatory state bar?
Your memory is wonderful. That's correct.
I think it's in the materials, too. So
it
was refreshed, as we say in the law.
It's been a lifelong track.
But this petition is a semi-free association petition. So are you speaking to this petition? It sounds to me like you're speaking in favor of a voluntary bar completely. And I don't want to interrupt what you're going to say, but just can you clarify that in your remarks?
If I had my choice, that's what it would ask for. But I'm speaking in favor of the petition as it's written because nothing else is before you.
Okay.
This is your compromise position.
I view it as a compromise position. Anyone that's ever tried a lawsuit against me knows how I feel about compromise, Judge.
It's okay to compromise.
Sometimes. When I was state bar president, one of the things I wanted to do was take a look at the payroll. And as CEO and chairman of the board, I thought I had a right to do that in any corporate structure. And it was a major fight. I had to threaten to bring a petition in the Supreme Court to look at the payroll. I finally was allowed to do so, but do so without a recording device, without a witness, and without even pencil and paper. I shouldn't have to associate with a company like that, any company.
Mr. Kammer, when you say you wanted to look at the payroll, specifically, what do you mean? What did you want to look at that you were denied access to?
Payroll, what the people that work for the state bar were being paid. That's what I wanted to see.
Yeah, well, there's a world of difference between looking at a general payroll and looking at what people are paid in general. You wanted to look, as my memory is, and I have a pretty good memory too, Mr. Kammer. I think what you wanted to look at was the specific salaries of what specific employees of the state bar were earning.
Yes.
Is that right?
That's correct.
And that is what you were denied access to,
That's
right?
That's correct. I ultimately got there, but with great restrictions.
All right. Please go on.
I made an amend at one time under the open records law of the state bar and was told that they were not a public body but rather a private club and therefore they didn't have to comply. As president, I asked why they weren't filing Form 990 like all other state bar associations with the IRS, which is what private clubs have to file, and I was told they're part of government. The state bar doesn't even know what it is, or won't acknowledge what it is, and I shouldn't have to join such an organization. You asked something about the access to justice. It's been mentioned a couple of times. Access to justice, I'm going to make up numbers, and I'll be about right, but I won't be perfect. I apologize. I didn't. When I was president, this was before computers were so sophisticated, so I have stacks of paper that would fill three filing cabinets. I didn't have time to go back through them all. Access to justice was funded before my tenure to the tune of about $350,000 or some number like that. I think that's the correct number. It was a big number anyhow. When I was state bar president, suddenly we had a request for funding for them for $35,000 or $40,000. And I was concerned about that. And I asked where the $350,000 went. And the answer was, well, they still got what's left of it, but they wanted us to reload the kitty because they'd spent $40,000. And my question was, how many poor people saw how many lawyers as a result of that? And the answer was zero. So where did the $40,000 leak come from? Well, these people were taking each other out to lunch, and that's where that money went.
Boy, that's a lot of lunches.
It's a lot of lunches. They must have eaten well. When you spend somebody else's nickel, it spends pretty easily, I think.
Did you ever get an accounting?
The only accounting I got was it was spent on meetings with lunches.
I mean in detail. A detailed accounting. X number of meetings, each meeting costs blank amount.
I didn't get that. Maybe I wasn't smart enough to ask the question. I don't know, Judge.
Well, it's hard for me to even get that from the state director here. So
I didn't hear you.
I said it's hard enough for me to get any of that kind of fiscal information from the director of state's courts. So I'm sympathetic with you, Mr. Cameron.
Thank you. At any rate, my point is that I don't think I should be forced to associate with an entity like that. Quite aside from what they do about lobbying, I don't think I should have to associate. I don't associate with charities that have the CEOs driving around in Lincolns and chauffeur-driven vehicles. I don't associate with people that squander money. I associate with a number of articles, organizations that favor access for justice, and I give them my money and I make my contributions. But it's a question of association in my mind, and that's what's bothered me about the state bar since 1968.
Thank you very much, and thank you for appearing today. Attorney Essenberg.
Good morning. May it please the court, I will try to be brief. It may not be in my character. But I rise today to speak on behalf of a principle, and the principle is this. Whether as a matter of federal constitutional law, state constitutional law, or simply good policy, people ought not to be compelled to join an organization that they do not wish to join, and they should not be compelled to support speech activity that they do not wish to support unless there is a very, very good reason. Now, the State Bar has said that we've considered in this past, and we've rejected it, and the law has not changed, and so why are we considering this question again? I want to talk about the policy behind all this at the end, but I think we need to pause and recognize that although as we sit here on October 30th, 2017, the law has not changed, it may be about to change. As we indicated in our submission several years ago in a case called Harris versus Quinn, a number of justices of the United States Supreme Court indicated they were willing to reconsider the rule in Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. Abood is the case upon which Keller is based. It is the case that says that it's okay to compel someone to support activities that are germane to the purpose for which an organization was formed, that decision coming in the context of a public employee union. 2 years ago, in a case called Friedrichs versus California State Teacher Association, the Supreme Court granted cert to consider whether Abood should be overruled. The matter was argued, and then tragically, about a month after the argument, Justice Scalia passed away. In March of 2016, the court announced that it was deadlocked 4-4. On September 28th of this year, after I believe all the written submissions in this rulemaking were submitted, The United States Supreme Court granted certiorari in a case called Janus versus AFSCME. The petitions in Janus are once again asking that Abood be overruled. Now, it's possible that Abood could be overruled and the integrated bar would survive. Right? The public employee union context is not exactly the same as the integrated bar context. But the Supreme Court in Keller thought that they were close enough that the Abood rules and limitations should apply. And if Abood falls or is substantially modified, then it may no longer be the case that only activities which are political or ideological or are non-germane can be supported by compelled dues.
Well, I think we don't need to worry about that because we have Attorney Levine, who has been a faithful proponent of picking up on anything the Supreme Court says that may change the obligations for bar membership in Wisconsin.
Well,
what do you suggest, Ms. Dassenberg? Do you suggest that the court just hold this petition awaiting the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think at minimum the court should hold the petition awaiting the United States Supreme Court. But I think as a matter of policy, the court should go beyond that. Because even if the integrated bar can somehow survive the decision in Janus, the principle that I began with remains. We ought not to compel people to support an organization that they do not wish to support. We should not
compel them. Your view is, even if it were constitutional, a matter of policy, this court should not do it.
Absolutely.
Is that right? What's the policy?
The policy, I think, is that we ought not to incur a liberty cost.
Well, but the Constitution says it's okay. Why should we go beyond the Constitution?
You know, I don't think that the fact that the United States Supreme Court has concluded that balancing the competing liberty interests and policy interests involved, that they are willing to countenance the existence of agency fees, for example, in the public employee context, means that these concerns about compelling someone to do something which they do not wish to do, to join an organization they do not wish to join, to support speech they do not wish to support, those concerns don't go away. It seems to me that what is constitutional is not necessarily a matter of good policy.
Professor, before you get too diverted down the policy road, which of course is going to be our exclusive province, and I appreciate your willingness to comprehensively answer while your time is still present, I want to ask you more about what I found very important what you were talking about, which was the cases that the United States Supreme Court has granted certiorari on. Have any of those touched upon or implicitly touched upon? You mentioned it's in the public employee union arena. Have any of them implicitly touched upon the compelling or mandatory state bar association?
Keller was a case that relied on Abood and said, look, Abood faced this tension between compelling people to support speech they don't like and what is particularly pertinent in the public union context, this free rider problem, that all members will benefit from the union, and therefore, if we don't have some way to at least have them pay for these core activities, they simply won't do it, and the purpose of the organization will be defeated. In Keller, the court rejected the bar's argument in that case, that they were really more like a unit of government than a union. The Keller court said, no, actually, you're actually quite like a union, and therefore the rule that applied in Abood should apply here. The difficulty, it seems to me, in an integrated bar situation is that the Abood rule is stood on its head. The state bar is not arguing here. They're not worried about free riders. In fact, their concern is that if the bar is voluntary, they'll have to do too much to actually serve the needs of their members and not support some rarefied sort of view of what the public interest in improving the administration of justice requires. That, it seems to me, makes this a much more constitutionally concerning case than Abood, because when we're talking about improving the administrative of justice, we are necessarily talking about something about which reasonable people can differ. And there's no reason to believe, even if we accept the fact that lawyers have an obligation to act to improve the administration of justice, there's no reason to believe that they have to do it as a single collective voice. I may choose to do so through the activities of the Federalist Society. Someone else may choose to do so through the activities of the American Constitution Society or the Wisconsin Justice Alliance. There's no reason to believe that it has to be done through a single collective voice, and in fact, compelling that it be done through a single collective voice is what raises, I think, the constitutional and policy concerns that I began with.
Thank you very much. Attorney Swanson?
Attorney Swanson, as you begin your comments, and I say this for others who may be speaking, one of the things I'm interested in hearing is about the fiscal and work impact or change of responsibility this petition may have vis-a-vis the Supreme Court, how it affects us, what we have to take over, and what it's going to cost us.
Right, and that was exactly the point of my question to Attorney Levine. That concerns me quite a lot.
And it wasn't fully answered, and I thought that members of the bar, among not necessarily you, but I just throw this out, that that's something that should be addressed by someone as we go forward. Both of us have indicated a real interest in that.
Well, let me just throw out my prepared spiel here, Your Honor. I'll turn right to page 3.
But you don't have to throw them out. File them.
Mr. Asenberg and I go back some years, and I respect his intellect. But the free rider, it just kills me to hear free rider here. This isn't really a free rider in the union context where somebody's getting a benefit conferred upon them and not paying for them. This is a duty that we undertake as lawyers. We take an oath. That oath requires us to further the cause of justice, to help the people of this state better use our system. This is an obligation, and this is an obligation that this petition, the petitioners don't want to help pay for. It's not a free ride. It's basically the rest of the bar is going to provide what their obligation is for them, and they're not going to do it or they might not do it. They may be of good heart and well-intentioned, but we will do it, and we do it now. And you know, not much has changed, really, since late. The bulk of the State Bar of Wisconsin activities do serve the function of elevating the educational and ethical standards of the bar to the end of improving the quality of legal services available to the people of this state. The cost of improving the profession should be borne by all of those who take the oath of our profession. We are in the terms set forth in Chapter 10 and Chapter 20, promulgated by Supreme Court rules by this body, public citizens. And that confers a different status to lawyers. We don't have to be lawyers. We don't have to take the oath in Wisconsin. We can go to law school and do something else. We choose to take that oath. We do it voluntarily, and we do it seriously.
Mr. Swanson, what should the court do on this petition, in your opinion?
Nothing, Your Honor. I would deny it. I deny it, actually.
That's what I want to know.
I mean, this petition doesn't make a lot of sense, actually. It still has a mandatory bar, and everything Mr. Asenberg freedom of association or lack of association, it doesn't accomplish it. Everybody's still a member of the bar. It just simply makes dues voluntary.
Mr. Swanson, one thing that Mr. Kammer spoke of, and you and I had the opportunity to meet not too long ago, and from my perspective, we had a very enjoyable, productive conversation. And one thing that Mr. Kammer, former State Bar President, raised during his presentation here today is a lack of transparency. In fact, well, he started his presentation as a freedom of speech, and then he went to freedom of association. The crux of his concern and his reluctance in regard to mandatory bar seemed to me to go to issues related to transparency. And the issues related to transparency with the State Bar seemed to me to fall under a couple of specific categories, which if we thought about it, which we don't have time to do a great analysis here, but we'll have time. and they relate to people who are funding the bar being able to know what the employees whose salaries they're paying earn. Now, first of all, one of the things he premised it on is he said, gee, when he asked about it in the open records context, he was told, now he used the phrase private club, could be private entity, but then in a different context, he was told it's a governmental agency. Is the bar private or is it a governmental agency?
Somewhere in between. It's hard to tell.
Well, you're
either a foot or horseback, I think, would be the best way to look at it. We're an arm of the Supreme Court. We're kind of a quasi.
And you exist under the authority of the Supreme
yes.
Court. So
yes,
to me, that puts you more in the camp of a governmental.
Well, to go right directly to your question.
Right.
I actually was on the Board of Governors when Mr. Cammer was president.
Would you please put the microphone closer to you?
I'm sorry. I was on the Board of Governors when Mr. Cammer was president. I actually absolutely agree with him. He should have been furnished the information he requested without any type of restraint other than decorum.
Why wasn't
keeping it private.
Why
I don't know, and frankly, I objected to that at the time. And today, I know what everybody makes. I mean, I can find out what everybody makes. I was on the search committee for the executive director and know exactly what we offered him,
He also spoke about the fight, the difficulty he had in finding out what is paid and what the money went for to access to justice. I wonder if steps have been taken to make it more accessible. I get the feeling, and this is not based on any kind of scientific research, but in informal conversations with members of the bar. And by the way, I appreciate everyone's discussion and presence here because one of my favorite speeches, and I'm speaking fast because I'm aware of the time, but I think it's important to note. One of my favorite speeches was given in 1968 by the president of a small liberal arts college, and it was called Unloving Critics and Uncritical Lovers. And the opening line of his speech was, neither individuals nor institutions benefit from unloving critics or uncritical lovers. What we all need is a combination of both. Those who are believers in the mission, but also are constantly trying to work for improvement. And so, with that framework in mind, I ask, is there any kind of way or procedure that a lawyer who's writing out the check every year, and most of our lawyers, as you know, in this state are sole practitioners, trying to keep body and soul together. Really. That I know. And they write out the check, and sometimes they wonder what the money is being used for. And I wonder if they ever had the time, and they were curious, and if Mr. Cammer, as State Bar President, had all sorts of difficulty, which you just confirmed he had difficulty, and you objected to him having difficulty, and you wanted him to have an easier time to get the information, I wonder what some lawyer practicing in northern Wisconsin or whatever rural area you want to pick who's curious about it and wants to know where exactly his or her money is going and what exactly it's being used for, what kind of means or method do they have to appeal to the bar to find out?
I think almost any governor, I think things have changed fundamentally since when Mr. Cammer was president.
How?
We have a new executive director. We have a new finance director. In fact, I don't think it was that way before Mr. Cammer
was
president.
All those things you mentioned are personality-driven. I wonder if there's any formal channel, formal means.
Well, yes, Your Honor. Actually, I think any member could go to a governor, and we're a democratically elected body here.
Right.
They could go to their governor, and they could say, look, I got some questions about this access to justice, if that's your example.
Yeah.
I'd like to know what they spend their money on, and the governor could find that out. We have an excellent finance director. We have books and records that you can find that out. I have an accounting degree. I got no problem understanding this. I think the people that don't have accounting degrees can understand it, too. And that information is available.
Okay,
why
so
do I have to go
so
to
I
the governor?
Could,
just wait, Shirley.
Excuse
Sorry?
Me. Justice Abrahamson, I know you rarely
go
you
ahead,
rarely
she's
get
waiting.
To talk during these
waiting.
Things, but let me ask. So I could come over to the bar in the next couple of weeks, and I can find out where the money is being spent on access to justice. I can find out what the specific, he used the general phrase, started with the general phrase, payroll. We all know that covers a multitude of things. But specific, what specific employees are being, as a member of the bar who pays his full dues every year, I can find that information out.
I would think so, Your Honor. And we, Your Honor, Justice Abramson, we go through a process in the budget that is very open through the Finance Committee, through the Board of Governors. We debate it. It is disseminated through the board. It would just be easier to come through a governor because the governor is sat through.
I can go right to the executive director. Why do I have to come through a governor?
You could go to the executive director, too.
Okay.
Mr. Martin is one of the most open and helpful people that I've ever met. And I'm sure that he would not withhold that information from any of you or any member of the bar.
Why not just provide it to the entirety of the dues-paying members of the bar in this court?
Well, I think you can actually access most of the budget online through WISBAR.org.
That's right.
I think if you actually fish around through that website, and we're going to make it better so you can easier find it, but you can find that out. It is not a secret.
Salaries of the personnel of the state bar?
No, we don't publish what every individual makes. I think that people have a certain modicum of privacy. They don't really want what they make.
What about the executive director?
I don't have a problem telling anybody what he makes. I think we get more bang for the buck there than pretty much any bar association. So, and by the way, to talk about bar finances a bit, If we go voluntary, for example, if this court were to determine overnight that we were going to go voluntary and some of these other functions would be mandatory, as the petitioners advocate, then you're going to have to develop a process to basically handle the money. So if we're a voluntary bar and you're going to create a new entity, much like OLR, to deal with lawyers' assistance, for example, who's going to deal with the back end of that? Who's going to hire the counselors?
I didn't hear that word. Who's going to deal with what?
Who's going to deal with setting up that new bureaucracy, like OLR or the Board of Bar Examiners? That's going to cost money. Who's going to collect the money? Do we still collect all that money, or do we just say, you do it?
That's right.
You know, are you going to pay for, where are you going to find in your budget the money to pay for these things?
I think that's part of the question that's been asked a couple of times. Tell the court the financial impact. What does the bar do for the court presently?
We do more than you can imagine. For the court. I mean, we basically hold all the records. We're the repository. We keep track of all the trust accounts for all the lawyers. We keep the roster of all the lawyers in the state.
Do you believe, and excuse me for interrupting this litany because we want the litany, but I want further definition. Do you think that those items are would continue as mandatory items, the keeping of the trust account information? Or is that not mandatory as you view the petition before
us? Well, I'm not sure. I mean, right now we are mandatory, so we don't have to deal with that. We're going to have to figure that out.
Well, the petition.
But we're going to have, if you take the Nebraska example as a perfect example, actually. I just came back from a regional bar meeting of bar leaders talking to the Nebraska president, president-elect, and their executive director about the fallout this has had. They suffered about a 25% reduction in paying members. They're spending money now on retaining membership and providing member benefits. That's money that add that on. Now, where are we going to make that up? That's cutting out a significant number of employees at our state bar. Less people are going to have to do more if we're going to maintain our programs. That's going to affect the lawyers and the people of the state of Wisconsin a lot. And it's affecting Nebraska. They've dealt with it, but not satisfactorily. And I know that Justice Prosser's here. I'm not sure if he's talking. He spoke with Liz Neely, the executive director, about this in particular, and he may address the court. And I'm out of time, but let me...
Can you go back, though, to the litany that you started in response to Justice Ziegler's question of what the State Bar does?
Oh, well, I'll tell you what... I'll tell you what will not be supported, at least in my mind's eye, if the petition is granted. The Access to Justice Commission. Will that be a separate mandatory thing? It's voluntary now. That's a significant benefit. We support the inculcation of into the profession of law students. We have an outreach to the law schools in this, and that's all voluntary. We educate the public about the legal system all over the place. Law Day, the kids coming through courthouses, that's all volunteers. We coordinate with the local bars to put those problems on. We have a local bar coordinator. That's all voluntary.
Court with class, which we coordinate with the state bar here in our chambers.
And we try to do that throughout the state, Your Honor. And again, that's a voluntary thing. Pro bono services or reduced fees for people of modest means. That's one of our programs. That helps us get more people representation in the process. You hear from the trial courts about the problem of pro bono or pro se representation and pro se litigants. We are trying to help through our voluntary arm to ameliorate that problem. End-of-life health care planning, and actually another program that we're thinking about, and that is what happens when one of those solo lawyers out in the sticks of Wisconsin dies without any kind of plan or anybody to take over their practice. That's a problem that really affects people. That's a voluntary program.
Why is the state bar the best entity, or it sounds like you're saying the only entity that could provide all of these things? Why do you think that?
Well, if we have, it's about money. It really boils down to money. And when we have a mandatory membership, all lawyers are required to pay fees to support these programs because it's our duty. If you can't do it yourself by going out and doing it, and say you're a corporate lawyer, you know, what are you going to do with pro se litigants? Well, the overarching programs of the state bar basically cover that. All lawyers have that obligation. We do it democratically, actually. I mean, we've got right, we've got left, we've got everybody in between. We've got 54 people on the Board of Governors. It's a debating society, but we basically come back to the middle in most cases. If we have a voluntary bar, what are we going to have? Who is going to be a member?
I hear you saying there are a number of good programs that would not be supported, but my question really is one of a fiscal nature. I thought I heard you say that the bar essentially collects certain amounts on behalf of the court and that the court would have to create an entity to collect those amounts. And that's my recollection of some of the things we've done in the past, raising dues, creating this, creating that. That's what I wanted the list of.
Well, actually, it's the Board of Bar Examiners and the Office of Lawyer Regulation currently. We collect the special assessments, which is about half of the total dues payment, and dole it back to those entities as they need it, I think on a monthly basis. If we were a purely voluntary bar, why would we do that? You would collect that money, and maybe the legislature would start looking at that pot of money as part of your budget because you're collecting it from the lawyers. Is that really what we want here, or do we want to keep that independent, which it is now?
Is there anything else besides BBE and OLR, access to justice?
No, we fund that out of money or money that we make doing other things, Your Honor.
Didn't we recently do sort of a corporate counsel or pro bono? There was where a portion of the fees that come in go, I think the bar collects them, and that's
pro hoc vice.
Pro hoc vice.
Yes, and we
so
also
see what I mean. That's what I'm trying to get a list of, and maybe this isn't the best person to ask for that
list.
Maybe someone along the line can give me a list of that because I'm curious. You know, the court will set up or need to set up an entity that would do what the bar currently does, and I want to know what kind of job is that, and what kind of person power is required to set that up. That's what I'm trying to get at, and I might not have been very clear.
We're kind of like private enterprise. We do it better because we do it efficiently. I think if it goes over to the government, and this is just me talking now, it's probably going to...
I thought you were part of government. I thought that was one of the things that you said you were part of the state government.
Well, Your Honor, we also collect the compensation fund. There's an assessment to compensate the public when lawyers do wrong. And that's the other fund that we collect and hold. And we hold that, and we actually administer it. We have, in fact, a panel where these claims come in front of, and we determine what to pay.
That's specifically covered under the rule. But what I think we're trying to get at is, look, the rule has four items and then a fifth catch-all. The first is mandatory is participating in our rulemaking process. The second is client protection fund that you just administering that fund, which you just addressed. The third is continuing assisting attorneys with addictions. The fourth is continuing answering ethical questions posed by attorneys. Those are the four things that are listed in the petition as mandatory. The fifth is the catch-all. So, do the publications fall within that?
No. No, Your Honor. We'd still have to do that, probably not give it to every lawyer, only people who pay their voluntary dues.
What about you indicated, and I just don't know the answer to this, you earlier indicated that you collect, that you monitor the trust accounts. Does that fall in with this rule? And if not, who's going to do it, and how is it going to be done?
I don't know who would do it if we didn't do it. We would probably continue to do it within our budgetary constraints, which would be severely impacted, I think, by this rule if it were implemented. There'd also be the other two. I think you'd have to have two new assessments. One, as you point out, for the impaired lawyers, and one for the ethics issues. So what are we going to have now? Instead of the three assessments we currently have, we're going to have five assessments. We're going to have to determine how much to assess for each one of those things. And then we're going to have the voluntary dues. So in effect, what we're doing is we're enlarging the scope of Keller if you adopt this rule, and, or I should say, minimizing what we can charge that is non-germane. So it just creates an incredibly complex situation if you adopt this rule. Now, the other thing that I've heard is the bar is bloated. The bar is fat. The bar's got a lot of money. And, you know, it's grown over the years. And what do we do with all this money?
Well, we don't want to be, as Justice Gableman, oh, I'm sorry, I thought he was here, uncritical lovers. So tell us what.
I feel exactly what he was telegraphing there. Sometimes, I mean, we have in the last 14 years increased the dues on average less than 1% a year, and I think you know what inflation has done over the last 13 or 14 years. We have gone from 105 employees at the beginning of that period to 90 now. We've come into the digital age. We've spent a lot of money and effort in getting the word out to everybody. We provided all sorts of benefits, the Case Law Express. We have free legal research for every one of our members should they avail themselves of it. Some of you can remember when only large firms had that type of access to the law. They had huge libraries and librarians. Little guys like me out in Oshkosh, Wisconsin, we had to pay West a fortune just to get the books, or go down to the local law library if we were lucky enough to have one. These are things that the bar has done with very little resource increase over 14 years over and above the cost of inflation. We have to continue in Madison to pay our employees, I think, more than the rate of inflation. So we really have done a lot with a little here. I just wanted to address that particular issue.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
You then disagree with Mr. Essenberg that this should be petition should be held pending the U.S. Supreme Court?
Well, I'd rather be denied and then see what happens. If somebody's going to
bring it back.
Your Honor, if somebody's going to bring a petition, this is not the petition to bring, where you have, in effect, a mandatory bar with voluntary dues. That's just not right. I mean, if the Supreme Court says that, you know, freedom of association is more important than our duty under the Supreme Court rules, let's take a new look at it then.
Well, you know, Thank you. 2012, I wrote a dissent.
I read it, Your Honor.
Pardon me?
I read it.
Yeah, I reread it, too. I'd totally forgotten it. And I wrote that no committee had been appointed since 1983 to study the state bar. My proposal to set up a committee to study it was defeated by Justices Prosser, Robinsack, Ziegler, and Gableman. My second choice at that time was hold a public hearing on the petition to deunify the bar, which is maybe what we're doing now. And that had been defeated by Prosser, Robinsack, Ziegler, and Gableman. And it seems to me we still might need a study. We haven't really looked at the state bar closely since 1983. What do you think?
If that's what you tell us to do, we will definitely do that.
Well, thank you very much.
It's not a matter of what we're telling. I asked, what do you think?
Well, I'm from the inside looking out, Your Honor.
I know. That's why I'm saying you haven't had an intensive study either inside or out. Since 1983, how many years is that?
I remember. I was on the Board of Governors then, Your Honor.
34.
A long time ago.
34 years. Hey.
It might be a good idea, Your Honor.
Might be a good idea. Thank you.
Fine. All right. Attorney Howell. Now, you've submitted terrific information to us, and you've heard a lot of what's gone on. I think that there is a lot of concern, or at least questions from at least three justices about what financial impact the changes that Attorney Levine would have on those services if they had to be picked up by the Supreme Court. So if you could add that to whatever you might want to say, having in mind you don't have a whole lot of time to repeat what you said, which was well done.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and thank you, members of the court. I think one of the later speakers is going to speak to some specific activities, but I'll speak in sort of broad general terms so that we don't repeat each other.
Good.
There are a number of services that the State Bar provides both to the court and to the public that will likely be underfunded at minimum and maybe defunded entirely if this petition were granted. And the petition, as a result, should be denied. Just so there's no question about what I think should happen with the petition, Justice Abrahamson. It should be denied.
What about a study of the bar?
Your Honor, that I think that the bar would welcome that. I think all of us benefit from critical self-examination as well as evaluations from third parties. I don't think the bar would disagree with that. I do think, there's been discussion about, is the bar bloated? Does it spend money on things it shouldn't? Obviously, that's a cost, but I think that that's a cost that the bar would welcome. I can't speak for the bar on that. I'm not on the Board of Governors, but I do think that's something that the bar would welcome.
Who should fund it?
Well, I think there's various ways it could be funded. One, it would be funded by the dues. It could be funded by the court if the court had money, but clearly that's an issue. The court already has its own budget.
Now, this is really off topic.
It is.
So
I'm
if
sorry.
You can please let her speak to the topic.
It seemed like it was gaining some traction. We should
see the topic?
If it's realistic.
The topic is the petition that's pending.
Well, I think the topic is broader than
just
petition.
Let her respond. She has something she'd like to say.
I
want to
make
that.
Sure what the scope of questions
are.
I think what to do is a broader question and encompasses the possibility of a study, not just affirm or deny the petition. Granted.
And I'm sorry.
Please proceed.
Well, didn't you hear what Justice Bradley asked?
I didn't hear the entire
question. She didn't ask a question. She said that she thinks the topic is broad enough to entertain questions about should the bar have a study done of its own functions.
Understood. Thank you.
And what's your view on that?
I think that there are a number of questions that can be answered. The study of the bar can be as broad as this court wants it to be. It can be something that could be something from the membership. There's lots of different ways to do that. This petition, however, doesn't address that. What this petition asks is for this court to create two separate, to require the State Bar to create two separate budgets. And the things that can be covered by mandatory dues are a very narrow subset of activities. If, however, that's granted, there are a number of activities that the bar currently provides and services it provides to this court that will go away or be underfunded. For example, the bar registers and administers fees for all LLCs, LLP, and SC law firms. That would have to be done by somebody else. The bar acts as the paper repository for copies of due statements, trust account certificates, and other information on all attorneys, as well as maintaining a list of all attorneys who are licensed to practice in this state. It also retrieves those records when they're required for various purposes. The bar collects and remits the mandatory fees assessed by this court for the Board of Bar Examiners, the Client Security Fund, WIS staff, etc. None of these would be covered by the categories of activities that the petition says would be funded by mandatory dues. What that then leaves is how does it get done? If the bar is, the rest of it's voluntary, there's nothing that says the bar has to spend its voluntary dues to perform those activities. And in fact, the bar, as we know from actual experience back in the early 90s, when the bar was voluntary for a few years, the number of lawyers who will choose to join the bar, particularly government lawyers and out-of-state lawyers, will drop dramatically. That same exact thing has happened in Nebraska.
Well, it was about 20%, if I remember.
And that was in only a couple of years, Justice. And if you give that some time, 4 or 5 years, I think the numbers are likely to go even higher. And on top of that, back in the 90s when that happened, everyone kind of knew that was going to be likely to be temporary, because shortly after the decision that caused this bar to be disintegrated, the Seventh Circuit reversed that decision and held that the mandatory bar was constitutional, that the arguments that we heard this morning, that the bar doesn't do regulation, that the bar doesn't improve the quality of legal services, that was wrong, and that was overturned by the Seventh Circuit. Ultimately, Keller came down, bar adapted its policies to match what Keller required, and then again later when Kingstead came down, the bar adapted that. Nothing about this petition is required by constitutional law, both as to the freedom of speech and the freedom of association. And this court has said that Wisconsin's constitution as to freedom of association issues is the same as the federal constitution. The U.S. Supreme Court has spoken as to what is required by the federal constitution, both as to freedom of speech and freedom of association. So long as the bar spends its dues, mandatory dues, on activities that are reasonably intended for the purpose of improving the quality of legal services and regulating the bar, those are permissible activities.
Counsel, you are counsel for the State Bar of Wisconsin.
I am, Your Honor.
So is it now spending any of its dues otherwise?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch all of that.
I want to know whether the State Bar now is spending any of its dues other than as required. Constitutionally.
Mandatory dues
mandatory
or other dues?
Dues?
Mandatory dues. No, Your Honor, I don't believe it is. And in fact, that's the process that you'll hear Ms. Behnke speak to in great detail in terms of the great lengths that the bar goes to protect members' First Amendment rights when it looks at the activities that it engages in.
So I pay a flat amount to the State Bar as mandatory dues, right?
Yes.
Okay. And then the State Bar says some of its activities do not fall within the mandatory dues, right?
The State Bar says that reasonable people could determine that some of those are not mandatory and therefore makes it subject to the Keller dues reduction, yes.
And therefore, I get a bar dues statement that gives the full amount, and then at the very bottom somewhere it says, and you can deduct $9.72.
That's
right?
Correct.
Okay. And if I want to fight that, then I have to go to arbitration.
That's correct. That is the procedure that has been approved by the U.S. Supreme Court. And in Wisconsin, it's been challenged and approved by the Seventh Circuit.
And that satisfies the constitutional free association.
Yes, I think it does, Your Honor. And one thing I want to raise about the free association argument, I think that the arguments here that we've heard this morning go too far. The arguments are that no one should ever be required to give support to any issues that they don't agree with. Well, frankly, as taxpayers, we're all required to support speech that we don't agree with. Even as to things that are clearly core issues of this court and of the bar and of the State Bar of Wisconsin, the access to justice to commission, representation of indigent criminal defendants, things like that, those issues are things that reasonable people disagree about, but they are clearly issues that the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court has said are permissibly funded by mandatory dues. So
that's true only if it is promoting a governmental message, correct?
I'm sorry, it's really hard to hear. I apologize. Mm-hmm.
That's true only if it's promoting a governmental message.
What's true? I'm sorry.
That you can compel the taxpayer example that you gave. You can compel a taxpayer to pay taxes, notwithstanding the fact that it will be used to promote ideas with which the taxpayer may disagree. That's true only because the message is a governmental message and it's part of its core purpose.
That's true, Your Honor, but as well, the U.S. Supreme Court has said regulating the legal profession and improving the quality of legal services is a core purpose of a mandatory bar. It's a governmental purpose
right.
that justifies so, that
yeah.
activity.
So improving the quality of services seems to be a category broad enough to swallow everything in the world. How do you define that?
I don't think that's true, Your Honor, and the reason I say that is because I have sat through the discussions that the State Bar goes through every single year in terms of what is chargeable and what's not chargeable, and there are activities every year that the Bar says, you know, maybe there's an argument there, but it's too close. We're not going to go there. We won't allow that to be funded by chargeable to mandatory dues because we respect the First Amendment rights of our members. It is a broad category, there's no question about that, but because the issue of justice is so fundamental to this society and because the ways that justice is improved and legal services contribute to that are such a broad and important topic, I think it has to be a broad category in order to adequately address the issues as they arise in society and as society changes.
Ms. Howell, are you for or against this petition?
Absolutely against, Your Honor.
Deny it.
I think that's to start with.
Good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Attorney Benke?
Welcome back.
Good morning. My name is Michelle Benke, and I am here as a past president of the State Bar of Wisconsin. And I will get this out of the way. I oppose the petition and support the bar remaining an integrated entity. Before I make my remarks regarding the Keller process, there's one activity for which the bar collects, which has not been mentioned, and it was, in fact, the last time that I was before this court, which was the assessment for WISTAF and the collection of the additional imposition of the additional $50 on lawyers to help support civil legal services. That's another item that we collect and disperse on behalf of the court.
You think it should be increased?
Time does suggest that those needs have increased and interest rates have remained low.
That's an issue for a different day, though, right?
That is an issue for a different day.
That's right.
I had to say that for my friend and colleague, Mr. Skilton.
Back there, I see him.
The court has made reference to the Keller process, and I presume that you understand it, but I did want to provide a little bit more in the way of process and detail. I'm going to use the term Keller as shorthand for the process, but I assure you that the State Bar, in conducting this process, has revised its methodology and the test in light of the 2010 Kingstad case. So, just so that everyone understands, we use Keller, but we understand the test to be Kingstad. I've participated in the Keller process in two different capacities. First, as an officer of the bar, president-elect, president, past president, and I sat on the executive committee and participated in the process. Shortly thereafter, as the adage goes, no good deed goes unpunished, I was asked to come back and assist the bar in that process. For years, the bar has asked a past president to facilitate and aid in the process of reviewing the materials for Keller. Dan Hildebrand did it for a number of years, Pat Ballman before me. I did that process, that facilitation, for 7 years. And so I've seen the process from both angles. And during the time that I facilitated, we operated first under Keller, and then after the Kingstad decision came down, I did it under Kingstad. So I've seen the bar adjust and revise its process in light of the rules and the requirements under the applicable case law. The Keller process usually begins in July or August of each year. We wait until the bar year is complete, the financials are audited, and then we know that those financials are ones that we can work with. And we go through the process beginning in that July-August timeframe. Ultimately, the Board of Governors votes on an amount in May or June, and that goes on to the due statement in the following year. So there's a little bit of lag, but it is premised on using audited financial statements. When the process begins, the bar staff collects information on the activities of the bar. We have data and information from arbitrations and court cases of those things that are germane and those things that are not germane. We separate those things that are clearly been decided into those two buckets. It is then everything else in the middle that the executive committee has to look at. That information is gathered and put in layers like this. It's copies of minutes. It's copies of articles, screenshots from websites, all of the material and activity of the bar. And then the executive committee sits down with the facilitator, and in recent years our legal counsel, to apply the Kingstead test to each one of those activities to determine whether it's germane or not. That process can sometimes be as short as a 2 or 3 hour setting. It can be as much as a half or three quarters of a day. The facilitator and our legal counsel keep the focus on the applicable test and provide some institutional memory on how specific activities have been treated in the past. As we go through that process, as Ms. Howell indicated, sometimes the determination is that it is germane, but it's a close call, and we actually apply, fondly called, the too close to call rule. And in an abundance of caution, we place that activity in the non-germane or non-chargeable category. No dollars are associated with the activity at this point. It is purely the objective test of whether that activity does or does not meet the germane test. After we have decided what's chargeable and non-chargeable, then the calculation begins, and the state bar staff goes through to begin to put numbers on things. Two quick examples. If, for instance, the Board of Governors has discussed both chargeable and non-chargeable activity through its year, our minutes are kept with a timestamp, and we total up all of the non-chargeable and compare that to the total. And then we take the entire total of the charges for a Board of Governors, and we apply that percentage. Likewise, with articles in the news, in the magazine, we tally up all of the things that we have discussed in the magazine, which are chargeable or non-chargeable, by a page count, and then we apply that percentage to the entire cost of the magazine. State Bar staff keeps track of its time, just like lawyers, in 25 or 15-minute increments, so that we know exactly what is attributable to the non-chargeable activity. And then finally, we also attribute overhead, things like the bar building, finance, HR, and we ratably apportion those expenses to the chargeable and non-chargeable activity. The final step, after we have actually determined the dollar amount that will appear on the due statement, we round up in an abundance of caution. So, if the dollar amount that is determined is $7.75, we will round up to $8.75, for example. We want to be sure that we are protecting the rights of those who may elect to withhold their dues for the speech or activity that they disagree with, but we are also rigorous in our process of determining what meets the determinations under Keller and under Kingstead.
Thank you. Thank you very much. That was a good pulling together of a lot of information. Attorney Burnett?
It's a long way from Green Bay.
Good morning. I'm George Burnett. I'm a past president of the State Bar of Wisconsin. It seems like a long time ago. There's been so much said this morning that it's difficult to know where to begin. So I think the best place is just a discussion of first principles. One wonders how it comes to pass that the court and our founders place so much trust and confidence in a group of men and women that comprise the bar. And listening to things today, one wonders if we have not become so sophisticated, life has advanced so far, that the organized bar is really nothing more than a trade union, a collection of merchants, a trade association.
So is it?
Pardon?
Is
no,
it?
I don't, and I'm reminded of, as I was sitting there, I'm reminded of a ceremony that we go through every year. It's a tradition that goes back to well into the 1800s. We do it in Brown County Circuit Court in the largest courtroom that we have, and I know some members of this court have been there. It's the opening of the court. And what we do is we introduce new members of the bar to old members of the bar. We eulogize those lawyers who have died that year. And the third thing we do is the answer to your question. We take the oath that many of us took so long ago. And I can tell you that in taking that oath, it's a reminder. It's a reminder of the responsibility each and every one of us carries as a member of the bar. So what is it that in that oath differentiates us from a trade union or a collection of merchants, a trade association? It is the thing that makes us a learned profession, together with the clergy and physicians. We have one responsibility, and that is to subordinate ourselves, to subordinate our interests in preference to those we represent. I dare say every lawyer in this state has experienced that or will experience it during the course of their career. So when I listen to the discussions and they're thought-provoking, I wonder what is it about this petition that will advance that goal, that will advance that objective. And I think there is nothing. This organization is good. It stands for something worthwhile.
You're talking about the state bar as the organization.
I am. It does things that no private organization can possibly accomplish. In thinking about this, I wrote down seven of them. There's a lawyer referral service, which is, I've been a participant for 25 years, and what it does is it gives members of the public access to a lawyer, usually a call of last resort. They talk to other lawyers and can't find any satisfaction. I dare say I can't remember the last time I actually accepted a case, but it gives members of the public an opportunity to sit down with a lawyer and who listens to them. That is important. Pro bono activities, the bar promotes them, a voluntary bar will not. Fee arbitration. We train young lawyers. In this day and age, there are so many young lawyers who hang out a shingle and they walk over to court and they represent people, flesh and blood. And like every one of us who was a young lawyer, they don't know much of what they're doing.
How do you train them?
The state bar is a resource.
How does the state bar train them?
Pardon? Well, we give seminars. There were back
at a cost.
Pardon?
At a fee.
At a very low fee.
And others give seminars too.
They do at a higher fee. The bar publishes a bar journal, and they publish books and publications that don't have an appeal to a wide audience. Those are the seven that I came up with. My concern is this petition will weaken the bar. And I am concerned that anything that weakens the organized bar is something that we should look very skeptically at.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Attorney Sorensen?
Madam Chief Justice, other members of the court. It's been really hard for me to sit here today because I have answers for most all the questions you've asked. I've been a bar junkie for 40 years. But I appear here today not because I'm a member of the bar, not because I was past president of the bar. I appear here for the silent majority. I appear here today because 70% of the bar are solo and small firm practitioners in this state. 70% of the bar relies upon the State Bar of Wisconsin and those programs that are essential to them.
Counsel, wasn't there a survey recently that indicated 57% of the bar preferred to be voluntary?
I'm sorry, sir?
Wasn't there a survey conducted relatively recently, excuse me, that indicated that 57% of the bar membership preferred that it would be voluntary?
I've never seen that survey, and if it is a survey, it's a survey based not on the question of do you want to still receive the publication, do you still want to have forms available to you, do you still want to have a research service available to you, do you still, you know, I practiced in solo small cities all over the state. I grew up in a small firm. For 34 years I practiced as a solo and small, and if it weren't for the State Bar, I couldn't have competed against the large firms. I'm in a large firm now. I know what the difference is. And I'm here today because there are solos and smalls that aren't here today. They're out there earning. And you know that they don't have the cash to really do any more than pay the dues. So if you ask them a question of whether or not they want to pay dues, of course they're going to say no. Because they need every dime they can get. Do you know that the average lawyer in Green Lake County alone only makes like $48,000? But yet they're serving the public. You know, George talked about this, and I really think it's important. We have a duty. We have an obligation. This court has an obligation to the citizens, and we have an obligation. When I stood in this room and I took an oath, and when I stood in this room as the president of the State Bar and asked the new graduates if they were going to commit to this profession, and I mean profession, not a trade group, not a vocation, but a profession. That's what this is about. And Justice Kelly, in order to provide the services, here's the reality. The reality is there's a lot of lawyers that pay that don't use the services because they're in situations where they don't need the service. I'm in a firm that I don't need the research services of the State Bar, but I willingly and voluntarily pay because it's my duty, because I was a solo and I was a small practitioner. I had a limited income, and I knew how important that was to the administration of justice.
Mr. Sorensen, if I may interrupt your soliloquy here, I'm curious. I asked Mr. Swanson, and I wonder, sir, as a past president of State Bar, is the bar, in your view, a quasi-governmental agency, or is it a private entity?
I think it's quasi-governmental agency of the Supreme Court.
So what do we mean by quasi-governmental entity?
I mean that it's an entity of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court controls what we do and what we don't do. The Supreme Court itself, if you say the Supreme Court, there's three branches of government. The judicial...
Oh, really?
I'm sorry.
Do tell.
Well, I'm not trying to be critical, but I'm saying we're part of the judicial branch of government.
Right. So can we drop the quasi and just say you're a governmental entity?
Absolutely.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah, I it's like...
Should this court have control over the State Bar budget then?
I think that the court should certainly have a right to review the State Bar. Yes.
Review it but not control it, even though you're an arm of the State Bar's an arm
again,
of the court.
Again, if the Supreme Court has the right to do what the Supreme Court feels is best for the State Bar, I have no qualms with that. As long as we're serving the needs of the lawyers and serving the needs of the public, if the Supreme Court takes that role, I personally, I can't speak for the organization, and they'll probably criticize me, but I personally have no problem with that because it's all about serving the public. Yeah, the other thing that I wanted, I mean, I've got lots of things I'd love to say and answers to questions. I was here in 1983. I appeared. I wrote a letter saying why it was important back then that we keep a mandatory bar, because those of us that practice, you know, in the small towns of this country or this state need that type of service. That being said, I also want to comment on something that was said about, this is, was near and dear to my heart, and I'm not going to let it go, is we talked about the Access to Justice program. Some of you know that my wife volunteers for the Access, and she's been involved with WSSTAF and Access to Justice for over 10 years now. And I can assure you the money's not spent on parties. I can assure you the money's not spent on sandwiches and lunches. And my office is often used free of charge for them to have their meetings.
Well, they've the used, Access used, to Justice Commission.
What?
Access to Justice
Commission.
And all the work was done initially and supported by the State Bar.
Correct.
And I congratulate the State Bar on that. And, in fact, the State Bar is still financially supporting the Access to Justice.
And they could use a lot more.
I understand that.
Because it needs, but again, I just wanted that clear because I knew there was a question about that. Transparency was an issue.
Thank you very much. We are really running out of time. So if you have something else to say that hasn't been said before,
sure.
We would love to hear it. But otherwise,
I do have one thing to say that hasn't been said before, and I have a unique position to say it.
Okay.
I served 10 years on the National Conference of Bar Presidents. I was the president of the National Conference of Bar Presidents. In that role, I watch mandatory and voluntary bars. I'm probably the only one in this room that has spent 10 years looking at the difference between mandatory and voluntary bars, also looking at states that have both mandatory and voluntary bars. In that sense, I can address a lot of the questions you had of what's the difference. And the difference between the two, you look at a state like Iowa. Iowa has a voluntary bar. Their programs that they provide are limited in scope compared to what we can do in Wisconsin. They don't support their local lawyers at the rate that we support our local lawyers. They also receive, however, lots of money from their legislature that we don't receive in Wisconsin. That's the same that's true of Minnesota. And so they have commissions, such as the Access to Justice Commission in those states, that are funded by the legislature. And if you want the classic example of what happens, go to California. California has, I think, now three bar associations. But the major bar association, which is controlled by the legislature, is the example we do not want, because when the legislature controls, I talked to the executive director of the California bar, that bar association, and I have a cost consideration to give you, too, because you want to know what the costs are going to be. But she basically says we can't make a budget until the legislature puts her budget together. And that's almost impossible to run a bar association with all the services that are provided if you have to wait till you get funding from the legislature. The result has been many, many separate, distinct organizations have been created, and they don't provide the services that they want. And there's no uniformity. They don't protect the access of justice. They don't protect the uniform administration of the rule of law in California the way the other states do. And the same is true in North Carolina. The same is true in Virginia. The same is true in New York. You can look at all of these states that have two bar associations. That's the point I wanted to make. If you create a mandatory and a voluntary, you're going to have to get the position of two executive directors, two presidents and boards of these two organizations. And there's going to be conflict between them, and there's going to be cost associated with that. That was the crying message I heard when I was on the National Conference of Bar Presidents, that it costs so much more money than it did for the mandatory bars, who we could look out a year in advance, 2 years in advance, 3 years in advance. The other thing you talked about was studying bar activities. I want you to know we do that, and I want you to know there's a provision in the bar that every single activity is looked at from a financial basis, and if it's not getting the bang for the buck, it's eliminated. Thank you very much. I'm sorry I talked
too
fast.
Thank you very much. Mr. Sorensen, you oppose. You want us to deny this, right?
Yes.
Right. Thank you. Okay.
Attorney Rogers?
May it please the court, my name is Christopher Rogers. I am proud to be the president-elect of the State Bar, and I'm proud to be in front of you, and I will be as brief as I possibly can. I am against this petition. I think it weakens the bar. As president-elect, I think of the year ahead of us. I think of the new lawyers coming into this profession, and I think of their need and our oath to have this profession bigger than the individual practices of our members. We have a duty to this court. We have a duty to the citizens of the state of Wisconsin, and no other profession does that. This petition weakens it, and it does not address the concerns laid out by Mr. Levine in the first instance. We need the active, unified members of the bar be a part of the solution. As an example, we've worked so hard over the last 5, 6, 7 years to increase our membership and their activities within the bar. Government lawyers, as we stand here today, make up a full one-third of the Board of Governors. I'm concerned with this petition that we would lose the voice of those members and members like the government lawyers, because we need them to solve the problems that we're facing and are about to face going forward. Problems that the bar is uniquely situated to deal with.
Mr. Rogers, first of all, thank you for being here.
Thank you. And second,
I think one of the themes that I've heard here today that cuts deep with me, because I hear it when I, you know, it's not like I talk about the bar with lawyers from across the state, but when I get around, it comes up. And one of the themes that I hear is, you know, there are people, Mr. Sorensen just spoke very passionately about all of the many services it renders, and I am beginning to learn more about the many services it renders. But there are a lot of lawyers out there in our state who do not have such intimate knowledge. And I wonder, now Mr. Swanson has very honestly and sincerely made the commitment to continue along the path which I think he started many years ago when he objected to the difficulties that then State Bar President Kammer had in getting access to the information. Do you plan, I know it's a ways off, but do you plan, too, on continuing the trend that has been established and is being planted by, firmly planted and rooted by President Swanson, to continue greater transparency so that lawyers across the state may know and be rest assured where there are a lot of people for whom $500 is a lot of money.
Understood.
And I think I've learned from my own personal experience in personal life, as well as here, frankly, in my professional life, that someone can have the best of intentions and, in fact, be doing the best of things. But if they're keeping what they're doing sort of, not secret, that kind of infers a plan or a mens rea, as they used to say, but not making it clear to those who are interested and especially those who are funding it, what exactly they're doing, that raises the suspicion and therefore raises the tension level. Do you think that greater transparency or continuing along the lines of transparency will assist the practitioners in being more supportive of the bar and more helpful in looking for ways to help improve the bar?
Short answer is, Justice, that I do. I was not here during President Kammer's stead, and I don't have the background for that. I do believe, based on some of the questions here, if I had to put feet to the ground, I think we're a private organization with quasi-governmental entities. But having said that, we need to have the commitment and the assurances from our members that we are stewards of their money and of the bar dues. And if that does not happen, we are undercutting our very mission. So transparency is key. Currently, I believe, the state bar budget is on the WISBAR website. I think it gets a little...
But you and I both know, and I'm going to stop, because the red light is on, and I, out of respect for the rules that the Chief Justice has laid down, I would like to talk with you. I hope our conversations will continue, but the red light is on, so I'm going to stop.
Let me...
Who has no respect for the rules that the Chief Justice has laid down.
Well,
as long as they're reasonable. Is there anything else that you want to add, since some of the time has been occupied by our questions as the incoming president?
Well, a couple of things. We have challenges coming before us that I believe the bar is uniquely qualified to handle if we have a unified, active membership. We need to get better at that. We need to continue to get better at that. But we are situated to handle problems that we don't even know are coming up yet. Northern Wisconsin counties that don't have enough lawyers is an access to justice problem. Corporations coming in that are, to a large part, unregulated, LegalZoom, those types of things, that leave our solo small practitioners potentially vulnerable. The bar is in a situation to handle those problems if we stay active and engaged. We need our members to do that.
Well, I appreciate that, and I want to congratulate the bar, especially on its program of access to justice. It set up a commission. It's pushed it through here and has been very active. So I congratulate that. On the other hand, I think the bar has not been active in any number of issues which seem controversial to the bar, and they seem to be afraid to take a stand. And the one that comes to my mind is recusal of judges. Where was the bar on that issue?
Well, the bar is a democratic.
Pardon me?
The bar is a democratic organization, and what we do consistently with regard to decisions involving the public is it goes through the Board of Governors. And we vote on that, we argue, we address that, and we go forward vis-a-vis the Board of Governors. And then we try to get a position that is consistent, that we can be the voice of the bar. With regard to that, in any kind of specific detail with regard to that, I would defer to my colleagues and Bobby Howell.
Pardon me? Well, Ms. Howell has already testified, so I don't know if we want to bring her back. You've been active in the state bar. You're president-elect, so that means you've been probably on the Board of Governors for many years, right?
I have been.
Yeah. So you're familiar with the issue of recusal.
Okay.
Right?
Justice yes. Abrahamson, we have Attorney Levine sitting here, and we will conclude this matter. I know recusal is close to your heart. You've pushed it and pushed it privately and publicly, and it's fine to talk about it, but this is not the forum for that. Thank you. If you have something else on the pending petition that you wish to mention, that's fine, but we are not getting into a discussion of whether the bar should support recusal or not.
Well, I understand the court's position and the Chief Justice's position on recusal. I want to know what the state bar's position is on any issue other than access to justice that is important for the public. Recusal of judges is just one of them. I'm not interested in what your actual position is, what your view is. I want to know what you're doing about it.
Thank you. At another time, I'm sure he'd be happy to answer that kind of a question, but it wasn't part of what he prepared to come and talk about.
Well, let
today.
Him say whether he's prepared to talk about it.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers.
Pardon me?
I can tell you that we take those charges seriously.
Right.
We're a democratic organization, and we try to analyze those in the democratic context of the Board of Governors.
And what
Thank you very much.
What did you discuss that?
Justice Abrahamson, you're really out of order. Please be seated. We will now go to Attorney Levine. I'd like him to have the opportunity today to respond to many things that have been said.
Mr. Rogers,
would you
I'm going
help
to call
me with
you
the...
and ask you.
Listed everyone, and I am very interested in what you have to say.
Is Mr. Kopp is going to appear?
I'm sorry, I didn't
hear
that.
He is not. He has withdrawn his appearance, or I would have called on it.
Okay,
please, Attorney Levine.
Thank you, Chief Justice Rogenczyk. Sitting here listening to all the speakers, I quickly concluded this rule is one the court should adopt because everybody doesn't like it.
Amen.
The people who want a voluntary bar, it's not perfect enough for them. They want an entire voluntary bar. The people who want the mandatory bar say it doesn't go far enough by listing all the specific activities which are essential that the bar performs. That can be corrected by adding activities to the rule.
Mr. Levine, one of the themes that I heard throughout the morning was that a mandatory bar is essential because we are a profession and because we've taken this oath that we have taken to favor the public's interest above our own with respect to the rule of law. What I didn't hear was why that commitment necessarily implies a mandatory bar. I had thought to ask that of Mr. Rogers, but his time expired. Perhaps you could help me out with this. Is there any necessary connection between the oath that we take, the obligation that we owe to the public with respect to the rule of law, that necessarily implies the necessity of an integrated bar?
I don't think there is. I agree with what Professor Essenberg said earlier, that every lawyer, when he or she takes the oath of office, recognizes that there's a commitment to serve the public. But that commitment need not necessarily be done within the confines of a state bar. Everybody should be able to decide for themselves how they want to serve and meet that commitment. If there's one final point that I'd like to leave the court with, it's this. When lawyers take the oath of office, they take the oath of office to act ethically, to serve competently, and to serve the public. But one part that I haven't found in the oath of office is, I agree to give up my constitutional freedoms, my freedom of speech, association, assembly, and petition. I hope that each of you will look into your hearts and ask yourselves, either under the Wisconsin Constitution or under your inherent authority to regulate the practice of law, do you agree that it's appropriate to force people to join an organization that engages in the political and legislative process with their money against their will? Because if the answer is yes, then I think those constitutional rights have suffered a severe aggrievement. And I hope you'll consider that issue very carefully. Thank you very much.
Counsel, thank you very much. Before you leave, and those are very eloquent closing remarks, I return to an inquiry that's been raised a couple of times this morning. It seems not as eloquent as your remarks were, but it's still a nuts and bolts issue that I want to proceed on. And that is the question that Justice Gableman was asking several times. In your opinion, what is the entity, the State Bar of Wisconsin, vis-a-vis private, governmental, quasi-governmental?
Well, I'll take the easy way out, Your Honor, by saying right now it's a hybrid. It engages in some activities that are regulatory and are designed to protect the public. It administers the Fund for Client Protection, clearly a public interest activity that can be designed as quasi-governmental. But it also does things like spend almost $100,000 on an advertising campaign to improve the image of lawyers. It lobbies the legislature to improve the salaries of judges and attorneys employed by the state. So it does some of each. What this rule is designed to do is to ensure that the State Bar has enough money to perform those activities that are governmental activities. But other activities, it should act just like any other voluntary private association.
If I can follow up on Justice Ann Walsh Bradley's question, I'm actually going to press you on this because It doesn't seem right that the definition of the nature of an organization is created by the activities it chooses to engage in as opposed to those it is assigned by its chartering entity, which in this case, for lack of a better phrase, is this court. Everyone I asked about it agreed that it is this court which creates the authority for the bar to exist, and it is this court which, I'm looking for a better word than enjoys, but which has the supervising powers over the state bar. And so I enjoyed your answer about the quasi-governmental nature. I'm just not sure I believed it. And what I mean by that is, seems to me that if an organization is created under the auspices of the delegation of power by the people, which one of our speakers was kind enough to remind us all, we have three branches of government, one of which we didn't get that far, but I'm thinking one of them is the judiciary, of which we sit at the apex in this state. You see where I'm going. So now, with that new clarification, and understanding that at the beginning of my remarks I was going to press you, what do you have a different response to
I think the answer to your concern, Justice Giebel, may be for this court to specify which governmental activities it wants the state bar to engage in, so that the court is mandating that, and to assure through mandatory dues that there's enough money to finance that, and that all other activities would be voluntary and supported by voluntary dues.
Okay.
Isn't that what your petition does?
Thank you for that articulate response. I appreciate that.
Thank you for your careful attention.
Doesn't your petition do that?
No.
I tried to think of as many activities that the state bar engages in that I thought were quasi-governmental regulatory activities. Like I said, that list is open-ended. It's not finite. If the court feels there are other activities, or the bar feels there are other activities, please add more.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for a fine presentation, and thank you for very good materials. Everyone that appeared today was very helpful to us. So this is going to conclude the hearing on Rule Petition 1704. We do have another rule petition that is scheduled for this morning, and that is 1703. We also have bar admissions that have been scheduled for noon today. And I am wondering, Attorney Schreiner, if you could come to the microphone and help me a little bit with scheduling, I would appreciate it. We have only 20 minutes left. I can't imagine that 20 minutes is sufficient for you and for Judge Fitzpatrick and Attorney Gleisner.
I think it will be.
You think it will be?
Yes.
All right. Very good.
I,
if you think it would be, then we will proceed.
I don't know how many questions I'm going to get.
You might get it.
Well, we will. If you think it will be, then we will proceed.
Chief, can we remain off the record just for a minute?
Yes.
Our marshal, at the beginning of the morning when we were discussing,
I understand that.
Okay.
She had suggested we quit at 10 minutes to 12. Okay. She just told me people can come and sit down, and then we will begin because they're in the courtroom already.
Fair enough.
Okay, so that we can proceed at noon. So,
how many admittees do we have at noon? Pardon me, 13?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay.
I need to get my materials for this next hearing. I'm going to ask the marshal to go get my materials.
Okay, that would be great. Attorney Schreiner, if you want to proceed.
Chief Justice Rosenzweig, may I please the court. I appear today on behalf of the Judicial Council in support of Petition 17.03, and I will be brief. because I think what the council has undertaken with this petition is simple. Even though Rule 23 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure, which we propose that the state Supreme Court adopt as the Wisconsin class action rule, in place of the one-sentence 1849 field throw provision that we've lived with for the last 170 years, is complex. I don't intend to get into that. You can ask me whatever questions you want, I'll try to answer them. But what we're saying basically is we need a class action rule. We need a set of rules. We need a set of regulations that tell judges and lawyers who have class action cases on either side, how do you run them? Now, we haven't had those rules in this state. We've had a very simple rule, and judges have done what they could to make the system work. They have, frankly, almost entirely borrowed from decisions under the federal rules. But we ought to have a set of rules. That's really all I want to say about that. And we think this is a good set of rules. They've been on the books since 1938, substantially upgraded in 1966, and then changed again in 2003 because there's an active advisory committee in the federal courts that keeps track of these things. And so
what you're asking for is what's in Appendix 1 to your petition, which right. basically are the federal rules, and if there's a change, you've either stricken what was there or written in an addition to the rule. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct, Chief Justice. It is. We have made it a principle. This court has made it a principle that we ought not to have differences in the rules between state and federal rules of civil procedure. We don't have to. It increases the cost. It increases the danger of people screwing things up. It increases the danger of malpractice from lawyers who have to practice under two different sets of rules. So we just propose the adoption of the federal rule. And that's all I really have to say. I want two things. First of all, we had to take care of the fact that impatient with the court, I think, in 1978 or 9, the legislature passed a Consumer Act that included provision for class actions. So there is a provision in Chapter 426 of the statutes on class actions. It is based on the 1966 version of the Federal Rule 23. It's never been upgraded. Rule 23 itself has been. So what we propose basically is basically to take out of 426.110 the class action provisions, the regulations that the legislature put in there based on the old federal rule, and to replace them with the current federal rule, and basically to say that consumer class actions, like every other class action, ought to be governed by the same set of rules.
So there will just be a referral back to WISSTAT 80308 for those parts of 426.110.
That's all.
Okay.
Mr. Schreiner, if I'm correct, the provision that you propose in 80308 to deal with residual funds does not have an analog in the federal rule. Is that correct?
Right. We left two things in the new rule because they were different and they were adopted separately.
Yeah. So and on that one in particular, and yeah. my practice never encompassed class actions. So under what kind of circumstances would residual funds be created?
Usually there's a settlement, Your Honor. There's a provision for how that money is to be distributed under the supervision of class counsel and a trust, perhaps. And typically it doesn't all get distributed because people don't show up and claim it. There's money left over.
And why doesn't that money go back to where it came from?
Well, because there's a rule that says where else it goes.
There is a rule.
And believe me, this is not easy. But what do you do with it? Most of the time, the defendant who paid it doesn't want it back. The plaintiff's lawyers maybe would like to keep it, but that doesn't seem fair.
Why would the defendant not want their? Why would the defendant not want its money back?
It's complicated, and there's an explanation of it in the materials from the 2003 consideration of the change in the federal rule. But that basically, this court a couple of years ago granted a petition that said that should go to the Wisconsin Trust Foundation. Mm-hmm. It doesn't require that there be excess funds, but it says when there are, that's where it goes. And the other one is a change the legislature put in, I think, in 2011 to say you couldn't have class actions to seek tax refunds from the state. I teach civil procedure, and I say one of the things you always have to look for is the state looks out after itself. So it carves itself out of class action. So we left that in. We didn't think you'd want to change what the legislature did or what you had done before.
I have a question for you.
Yes, Your Honor.
One, and I'm looking at your petition, if I understand it. And to certification order, there's a note. Will that be eliminated? It says, note, statutory style is to use shall or may in commands and authorizations. Early practicable without definition seems very vague. What do we do with that note if we adopt this petition? You changed must to shall because that's the statutory,
right.
The usual language we use. But we have still at an early practicable time.
Could you tell me the section number, Your Honor?
Yep. I'm at, in your petition,
right.
Which is in our tab 2.
Okay.
It is subsection 3 called, entitled Certification Order. It's
right.
On page 4 of your petition.
Right. And that
sub 3,
is,
time to issue.
Right. That is
3A.
That is not a comment.
Pardon me?
That is not a note from the council. That's a part of the rule.
This is from Hazley?
I'm sorry?
From the revision of statutory revision office?
Yes. The change, the difference, which I guess I need to look at the appendix to the petition to
right.
Tell me what the redlining was. But those changes were entirely to keep this in accordance
statutory,
with the legislative
yeah.
So, reference
so
bureau.
So the shall under 3A is okay, right?
Yes.
And early practicable stays.
That was a subject of great discussion in 2003, and the concern in the federal system, that is the federal rule,
right.
The concern in the federal system was that sometimes the old rule used to say as soon as practical, and some
all
judges
right.
said, I'm going to certify something today. As a matter of fact, there was a judge in Cincinnati once who did it before the answer.
All right. Yeah.
So this says it's perfectly legitimate, and you should allow, in some cases, for discovery limited to the class issues before you certify a class. It should be based on a determination.
It doesn't say should. It says shall. Must. Shall.
And that's because the feds use must.
Okay.
And we say
right.
shall.
I have another question.
Yes.
One of the provisions in your petition was, is there a difference, altering or amending the order? Is there
right.
a difference between altering and amending? Is there a difference between altering and amending?
And again, yes, that's just the language of the federal rule. And it makes clear that a certification order, once it's entered, is always subject to being altered or amended.
Okay, so you want to leave that as
we do.
Drafted.
We do.
Okay. And you have no objection to changing must to shall here.
Well, we tried to comply with what our understanding of the drafting.
That's what I'm asking you about.
One other thing, two other things. One of them Judge Fitzpatrick will address. It has to do with the note under sub 6 of the statute dealing with particular issues. And I'll leave that for him to discuss. It's something he encountered when he had a class action as a senior judge. It's an important point, and why we've asked for some clarification that 805.05.2 and 805.09.2 don't require in a class action that the same jury decide liability and damages if there is a class action with respect to particular issues. Class action provision wouldn't work very well if you couldn't have a class action with respect to particular issues.
If I may, I don't want to interrupt your flow.
No, no.
Counsel, I have a couple of concerns about this proposal.
Right.
Justice Kelly indicated in his practice that he didn't do class action, but three members of his prior law firm wrote an article on class action and changing the rules in Wisconsin. And in that article, it indicates in part that 43 state statutes based on Rule 23, in fact, of the 43 state statutes based on Rule 23,
Only a few states have adopted every provision of the federal rule. That we are adopting every provision of the federal rule plus two.
Well,
why should we do what only a few states have done?
I think what they've done, Your Honor, is adopted them at particular times, and the federal rules get amended regularly, right. Sometimes as often as once a year.
This article is 2011, certainly after the last amendments.
Well, after, say, Arkansas adopts Rule 23, some change gets made in the federal rule so that the Arkansas rule is no longer consonant with what the new federal rule is. I think that's what that means. I don't think that there have been a lot of conscious choices not to follow the federal rule.
What I'm reading in this article, that only a few adopted every provision of the federal rule. I know that the ABA puts out regularly a handbook on the laws of the 50 states vis-a-vis class actions, but I have not taken the opportunity to secure that book.
We thought that was beyond the purview of what we wanted to do. We simply wanted to propose to the court that it adopt the current Federal Rule 23.
Well, I know.
And into what changes might be made.
I guess it sounds simple. I mean, currently our statute is 49 words.
Right.
And you propose pages of change.
We do. We propose we have rules. We actually have rules.
And indeed, that's good. Rules of civil procedure. And so one would think, of course, these are procedural rules, and the court has authority to pass them. Right. But the court has authority only to pass procedural rules if they don't affect significant rights, if they don't modify or abridge significant rights. And it seems to me that in changing some of the procedures here, that some of the significant rights may be affected. I note also that this article to which I refer anticipates that the legislature is the entity that's going to be changing a call to reform Wisconsin's class action statute. Yet you come here. In the interest of time, I'm piling on. You're going to have to remember these things. I can ask you discreetly. The final thing is, what about separation of powers? It's one thing to ask us to change the rules of civil procedure. I have some concern because I'm not sure this is just a slight change, 49 words to several pages, that they don't affect significant rights. For instance, as the article goes on to say, compounding the problem is Wisconsin's grant of sole discretion to circuit courts for manageability evaluations. That's going to change. Is that a significant right?
You know, counsel, I'm going to call this hearing. We are about 3 minutes from 12. I'm sorry that you all have had to wait, Judge Fitzpatrick and Attorney Gleisner. I hope you will come back again after lunch. But we do have admittees scheduled for noon, and I can tell from the length of what Justice Bradley is talking about.
We're happy to come back. Before I leave, just point Justice Bradley to pages 3 and 4 of the memorandum in support of our petition, which point to a U.S. Supreme Court decision saying that Rule 23 does not affect
It's substantive rights, not significant rights by which we are limited.
Substantive rights.
And right.
Not, because they're,
during the break.
Under the Rules Enabling Act, the U.S. Supreme Court.
Excuse me. Yeah. When you come back, Mr. Schreiner, maybe you want to go over the several pages and see if any of the substantive rights of any potential litigants are affected by your proposed change in order to articulate a response to Justice Bradley's concern.
What's that?
Okay.
No, we are going to take a break. We are going to take a break because we have people waiting to be admitted.
He's trying to find out what time we're returning.
I know that, and I will be happy to tell him.
Good.
We're going to return at 1:30.
Okay? Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.